Welcome to the sixth PLP JR North conference, which is a sellout today, I'm told. I'm Steve Cragg. I'm the chair of the Public Law Project Trustees, and I'm also chairing the morning session today. I need to say a few things before I start, thanking our sponsors for today. We're sponsored by Garden Court North Chambers, who've given us a lot of support over the years, for which we're very grateful for. Erwin Mitchell, newer sponsors of the PLP conferences, but been very enthusiastic in the help that they've given us. And also BPP Law School, who've given us the space to have this conference today, for which we're very grateful for. I want to just start today by saying a little bit about Public Law Project and what it does. Some of you will know very well what we do, but some of you may not have had very much to do with us in the past. And you may have seen our five-year review as you came in and picked that up, because it's a riveting reading and just explains what we've been doing over the last 5 years, and also gives a review back of the last 20 years of PLP work. These conferences that we hold, we now hold them in London, Manchester and Cardiff every year, and they've all become an essential part of the work that we do. But it's only a very small part of what we do as a Public Law Project. As some of you will know, our overall aim is to increase access to public law to disadvantaged groups and people. And we have a number of ways which we do that, which we try and run the particular ways in tandem. So we have lawyers who run test cases from London at the moment. And so we have test cases on things like community care, welfare rights, rights of immigration detainees, to name but a few of our recent successes. We also provide public law advice to voluntary sector groups and advice groups. And so if voluntary sector groups have problems with local authorities with funding, then we have a service whereby we advise on that and whether public bodies are acting lawfully in relation to that kind of thing. We also, in cases, intervene in public law cases in the courts right up to the Supreme Court. So we've been involved in cases involving protective costs orders and that kind of thing. And then alongside that, we also carry out research into the effects of judicial review and complaints procedures and that kind of thing, often in conjunction with the university research departments. At the moment, we're halfway through a project researching the consequences of JR cases. What happens to a case when it comes to an end? There's been a judgment by the court. There's been a settlement between the parties. What effect does that have on the public body in the future? That's the kind of thing we're interested in looking at, and there'll be a report coming out in a year or so on that. And then on our policy side, we often coordinate voluntary sector responses to changes in the law on legal aid and things like that, with the focal point for putting forward sometimes submissions to government on things like that. So that's more or less what PLP is doing at the moment. We've got a website, we're on Twitter, as everybody should be these days. As I say, we've got our annual report. So I think that's enough from me today about what PLP does. And we've got a stellar lineup of speakers for you this morning. To start with this morning, we're very fortunate and very pleased that Mr. Justice Hickenbottom, who's a High Court judge, is able to be with us today. He's the liaison judge since the start of the year for the Northeastern and North circuits, and has agreed to open our conference today. I think with no further ado, I'll hand you over to him. Thank you very much, Judge.
Well, good morning, everybody, and it's a real pleasure to be able to open your conference this morning. A conference on challenges to justice. One challenge which the liaison judge has already met this morning is to get on a train before 7 o'clock. The second challenge was for us to start more or less on time, which has also been accomplished. The theme of this conference, which is Challenges to Justice, seems to me to be particularly apt and timely. We and the rest of the justice system face quite prodigious challenges in the immediate future. Some of those challenges arise out of the general economic condition, as that affects the whole of our world. Everything else being equal, the legal professions would still face the same downturn in economic activity that accompanies any recession. The pressure which the professions are under, though, is accompanied and compounded by the challenges posed to lawyers by such things as alternative business structures. There is a general consensus that they will have an enormous impact, but although nobody's actually sure precisely the form that impact will take. Many here today will have genuine and understandable concerns about what the professions will look like over the next few years, and closer to home, how they will continue to make a living from the practice of law. However, the public law project, who've organised this conference, have a focus really elsewhere. They have a focus not on the well-being of the legal profession, but on the justice system. If you like, not on lawyers, but on the law. And they're to be commended for that, particularly in these times. The more pressing personal financial hardship is potentially, the more likely it is that we will have self-interest in the forefront of our mind. And it's important that we are forcefully and regularly reminded of the wider picture and the wider public interest that we as lawyers serve. There is, of course, some overlap between the interests of lawyers and the interests of the law. It shouldn't be forgotten, although it frequently is forgotten by commentators, that the law functions through lawyers, and lawyers do an incredible amount of work, not always paid, or not always paid properly, to maintain the justice system. The justice system is a vital pillar of any democracy. It's the embodiment of the rule of law, which is embedded in the very roots of our democracy. Judges, of course, but also practicing lawyers, work to uphold the rule of law and consequently play an essential constitutional role. And one challenge we face is to protect that position. We face a number of challenges to the independence and the integrity of the legal professions, from, for example, regulation and the introduction of the new business structures to which I've referred, which very obviously have the potential for tensions between efficiency and the paramountcy of the consumer on the one hand and professional standards and ethics on the other. For those who are interested in such matters, which I suspect will include everybody here, the recent Lord Slynn lecture by Lady Justice Hallett should be compulsory as well as compulsive reading. Furthermore, without, I hope, too much special pleading, the government funding cuts have hit the justice system particularly hard. The justice system is, relatively speaking, a politically soft target. The cuts have meant substantial court closures, the withdrawal of funding from many types of work, and the closure of voluntary organisations which were originally funded to replace commercial legal advice facilities that had their funding withdrawn some time ago on the basis that they'd be replaced by voluntary organisations. The result has been, I think, that access to justice has become difficult for very many, and one fears an illusion for some. Although, of course, we must keep this to ourselves, some of the law is absolutely straightforward. Unfortunately, much is not, and that is why we have a lengthy and exacting process of education, training and examination over at least 6 years for most before, as qualified lawyers, we are let loose on the public. A good proportion of the law that is not in the straightforward category affects large sections of the population and particularly affects those who are less able to engage properly in legal proceedings, the vulnerable, the less able, the deprived in areas such as housing, debt and welfare. The courts, of course, do what they can, but there is a limit to the extent that judges can advise litigants on the law, and in any event, too little attention has been paid at something on the knock-on effects of these changes, for example, on the time cases take with litigants in person. They enter the justice system unrepresented and sometimes bewildered, with certainly some subjective complaint, but perhaps with no cause of action, but often with some case of merit, but without adequate understanding of the possible legal bases for any claim or how any claim might be made good. And the justice system is currently struggling, and I certainly use that word advisedly, it is struggling to deal with the ever-growing numbers of litigants who are self-represented. How we deal with them in the future needs consideration. It probably needs guidance, perhaps building on the recent Civil Justice Council report on such litigants. So the challenges to the whole of the justice system are not difficult to find. And it seems to me that they are so potentially overwhelming that we run the risk that by the time we get to specific challenges to a particular part of the justice system, such as the public law field, which is the real focus of this conference, we may be disheartened or even mentally exhausted. How, you might think, can we fully concentrate on the rights of appeal from the upper tribunal to the Court of Appeal when we are aware of a tsunami of potential change that might and probably will affect the topography of the law as a whole? However, in the turbulent legal world that we live in, we must remember this. The issues that you will be addressing today are important, and they're important not just to us as lawyers, as academic problems, but important to the public as a whole, for whom the administrative justice system is vital and growing in importance as more and more areas of our life are governed by regulatory schemes. And just because all members of the public or the media or the other limbs of government do not always appreciate the crucial role that this part of the justice system plays does not make it any less objectively vital. You're covering today many of the issues that are faced by the administrative justice system, and I would just like to highlight a couple and focus on the challenges facing the institutions that deliver administrative justice, particularly, of course, the administrative court, which I'm responsible in the north and northeast. The administrative court is simply overloaded with work, and the work continues to expand exponentially. The administrative court was formed in October 2000, taking over public law work from the Crown Office list. That list, which I think itself was only formed in 1991, was derived from the Crown side of the Court of the Queen's Bench, and then after the Judicature Act, the Queen's Bench Division. This court historically dealt with primarily the old prerogative writs, They required the government to do something, or more usually, not to do something. More eloquently, in 1996, the role of the court was described by Lord Bingham in a case called Ex parte Smith as having, quoting him, the constitutional role and duty of ensuring that the rights of citizens are not abused by the unlawful exercise of executive power. As a matter of constitutional principle, the court deals with the most important cases that there are. And over and above that point of principle, the cases are often of the utmost importance for the parties, and particularly, of course, the claimant. This is a serious area of the law that warrants both serious consideration and debate in conferences such as this, and also proper, efficient and timely resolution by the court. When the Crown Office List was set up, there were a handful of cases. They were all dealt with by a divisional court, a court of more than one judge. They always had a Lord Justice of Appeal. They usually had the Lord Chief Justice. That was in 1991. There are now over 1,000 cases issued per month. There are 50 cases issued every working day of the year. Two-thirds of all Queen's Bench Division work is now in the Administrative Court. But although there have been some changes, the Lord Chief Justice has found other, if not better, things to do. But other than those fairly minor changes, the cases are still dealt with essentially in a system designed for a tiny fraction of the current workload. The dramatic rise in the amount of work is substantially accounted for, of course, by immigration cases. They comprise now about 75 to 80% of the work of the court, and that percentage is rising. Efforts to reduce that load have failed. The rise in cases is inexorable, and indeed the position is likely to worsen because of the government's policy of reducing appeal rights in immigration cases, leaving the only right of challenge one exercisably in the Administrative Court. Of course, consideration of which government decisions attract proper appeal rights is to a large extent a political matter. It's trite law that judicial review will do as far as the rights to a fair hearing are concerned. And our application for judicial review is really a limited right of appeal on restricted grounds and with limited, often very limited, often destructive available relief. But the sense, as well as the fairness of reducing appeal rights, has been questioned by some. I was the judicial lead in the implementation of the Tribunals, Courts and Enforcement Act 2007, which set up the reformed tribunal system. That system was, and is, based upon a model of a government decision being fully appealable in a first-tier tribunal, with an onward appeal on a point of law only to a second-tier tribunal, and then onwards and upwards to the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court on the usual limited grounds. In my view, the government's support for that model was well-founded. The support was based on the fact that the approach was principled and allowed proper access to justice. Those who oppose the reduction of appeal rights say with some apparent force that it is misconceived to remove them and thrust this huge volume of work in the form of judicial reviews, which is in many ways a procedurally clumsy mechanism, onto the less well-equipped court system. Give every decision a full right of appeal to a properly equipped tribunal with, where appropriate, robust and speedy procedures. The time taken to get a substantive hearing on in London in the Administrative Court is currently a year, and it's simply inconceivable that a full appeal, even through two tiers, would or should take that long. But as you will all well appreciate, that solution, although it has the characteristics of common sense and principle, is currently politically unacceptable. The result is the overwhelming of the Administrative Court in London, as I say, set up to deal with a few hundred cases a year and getting 100 cases every 2 days. And the Court of Appeal, the Court is simply not able to keep up with the growth in the work. Action is being taken as an Administrative Court master is being appointed, a new type of appointment, to deal with much of the case administration and to start putting into place systems for dealing with this colossal amount of work. And I would hope, personally, that immigration work is dealt with in a separate list so that it is given appropriate priority, but also non-immigration cases can also be given the priority and attention that they too deserve. And certainly, in respect of the Administrative Court, judicial resources are being poured in. But those steps will clearly not be enough. And in the longer term, I'm sure that the answer is to transfer the immigration work, including judicial reviews, into the tribunal system. Unfortunately, that is prohibited by statutory provision, and the first step will be to get the statutory provisions changed. An initial step, which was to transfer judicial reviews which concern the refusal of representations as a fresh claim, has not been a success in practical terms because the transfer provision only applies to pure decisions of a refusal of a fresh claim, and those decisions now are often, they are usually linked to a further decision to certify the claim as clearly unfounded. And as soon as the fresh claim decision is linked to any other decision, it has to stay in the Administrative Court. And the result has been the transfer of relatively few cases, very low hundreds, compared with the thousands of cases that are issued. As I say, the transfer of other categories of case will require primary legislation. I am reasonably optimistic that such provision will be made, and soon. The reputation of the upper tribunal has steadily improved, and certainly improved since Mr. Justice Blake has been the president of the upper tribunal chamber, and there is general acceptance now, I think, amongst both politicians and senior judges that senior immigration judges can and should deal with the bulk of immigration judicial review work. That move would free the Administrative Court to deal with other non-immigration cases, and the Court can, I hope, return to being a dedicated court of high calibre that deals efficiently and quickly with challenges to government decisions, which often cry out for speedy determination. Of course, High Court judges will be able to sit in the tribunal to deal with any cases of principle that there are there. But the rehabilitation of the Administrative Court is, I think, one of the great challenges facing the court system at the moment. The problem with the Administrative Court is essentially a London problem, because that's where the vast majority of immigration cases are issued and dealt with. The Administrative Court now, of course, has had regional offices for the last 3 years, offices in Manchester and Leeds, as well as in Birmingham and Cardiff. Sittings in Bristol are due to start before the end of this year. I was the designated civil judge in Wales during the planning period for these offices, and was enthusiastic about the initiative that was that of the President, Sir Anthony May. That initiative has undoubtedly been a success. About 15% of the work of the court is now done out of London, a proportion that continues to rise. But I don't think that success can be measured purely in such statistics. The real success of the project lies in the fact that people in the regions can issue and have their public law cases, which often have a very strong local element, heard locally. An additional mark of success, I believe, is the growth of the professions in regional centres, but markedly in Manchester, which I think now has clearly the strongest public law bar outside London. Both Manchester and Leeds have first-rate local judges, as well as High Court judges visiting. We now have at least one High Court judge in the north sitting on administrative court work during the whole of every term. And the lawyers and the staff in the centres are first-rate, they're experienced, they're knowledgeable, and they're dedicated to making the regional offices work and work well. And the result in the regions is a prompt, more heavily case managed and often hand-tailored service for administrative court users. It's important, I think, for the administrative justice system as a whole that the regional centres continue to thrive, and that is a particular challenge for Manchester, and consequently a challenge of particular moment for this conference, which is being held in Manchester. We should see the work in the regions continue to expand, not just in terms of numbers of cases, but also in types of work. Already the largest and the most important cases are being issued and kept in the north. 2 days ago, for example, Mr. Justice Foskett gave judgment in a case called MK, which was a case concerning the tension that can exist between, on the one hand, the obligation of the state to provide temporary accommodation and assistance for those seeking asylum who are at risk of being destitute while their application for asylum is being considered, and on the other hand, the desire of the government not to incur considerable public expense in doing that, in cases which are unmeritorious, which many, but of course not all, are ultimately found to be. So that was a case involving what would be called in the old days matters of really quite high political significance. It was an important and in some ways groundbreaking case which was issued and heard in Manchester. We will make appropriate judges available for all and any cases in the north. And furthermore, the President, who came to Manchester 2 weeks ago to sit in a div court with me, and he's coming to Leeds to do the same in 2 weeks' time. Lord Justice Moses is coming up to Newcastle next week to hear a divisional court case about Durham Prison. The President's committed to having divisional courts. He's committed to giving the regional offices the full scope of administrative court facilities, there will be regular divisional courts in both Manchester and Leeds every term, which are being inserted into the itinerary. So we face enormous challenges in respect of the justice system as a whole, and particularly in the administrative court and in public law. But administrative justice in the north is looking healthy. It's looking increasingly healthy with the opportunities that the regional offices of the administrative court in Manchester and Leeds being grasped by the professions with both hands. Public law in Manchester is thriving. Long may it do so. In the meantime, can I wish you a good conference? The programme looks an excellent one, and I'm sure that you will enjoy and benefit from the day. Unfortunately, I can't stop because I'm required to go and dispense justice as best I can over the other side of the Pennines. Indeed, if you ask the right person, I am already in Leeds. but I certainly hope I will hear the results of the conference in due course. Thank you all very much.